Welcome. You're listening to Refusing to Implode Politely, a show all about London spoken word, with me, Zoe Stegosaurus.
Karaniya mata kusalena yantan santan padan abhisame chasa go uju chasu uju chasu huva cho chasamudu anatimani. Reasons for learning and chanting the suttas. For the sake of the tune, for your fullness of voice, for what remains in some muscle memory of the mass and of incense, to keep words to hand, your metas or your nibbanas, which will never fully translate themselves, but keep their strangeness intimately, to sound out an authority in the opening of a vowel, to know salutation in the small of the back, the pronunciation of prostration, since the mind learns no faster than the body which bows. Or simply for this, it is reason enough that things are forgotten, or rather forget their way to us if we do not remember to make our mouths with all due diligence habitable. As Rabbi Heschel said of prayer, not to be granted anything, but to be worthy of granting, to be worthy in the very throat of the song, like a bubble in the filling pool of your bodying, sat in the curtained dark, singing, still point of the tuning world. Kame suine agedang nahija tugahawa sehiyang punare ti.
Really, really nice.
Thank you.
I think I've heard all of those in performance previously,
yeah.
But
apart from Brand New, I haven't debuted that one yet. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. A few of those are favourites of mine, and they seem to go over quite well with an audience. So good to know that they haven't passed unnoticed.
Yeah, I will announce us. Welcome everybody to Refusing to Implode Politely. You've joined me for an interview with Mr. Tim Kiley, who is a seasoned spoken word performer on the London scene. I guess the difference for me between seeing you on stage and seeing you very kind of up close do your work was, I think your particular style of delivery, actually, despite me having called it declaratory earlier, which I stand by, I think it's got something quite intimate about it. Like, particularly that first chanting piece, I felt had something that was very, well, obviously something that was very aural about it, but to the extent that you were not just in the singing and the chanting, but to the extent that also kind of I felt like there were these echoes of like Seamus Heaney-esque kind of, like, the way some of the language that you picked and chose, and that the words that felt very evocative towards the end of it, I thought were.
Oh, thank you very much. First of all, can I just say that one of my own lifelong ambitions there is for somebody off the cuff to make a comparison between my work and Seamus Heaney. So thank you for that. You've paid me an immeasurable compliment there. As it so happens, yeah, Seamus Heaney was and still is, I think, one of the poets that I've come across that has played a big part in formulating my own voice and sounding that out through the process of my own reading. And I think one of the qualities that you identified there of a combination of weightiness and authority with an intimate and personal direct voice is certainly one of the things that struck me most and continues to strike me about the particular way that he wrote, and that certain other poets who are dealing with lyric, I suppose you could call it lyric and personal subject matter, but in a way that's also intensely conscious of, in his case, his great public persona as a poet, have a very interesting way of trying to balance those two qualities. Obviously, you know, I'm not a Nobel laureate. I'm not, you know, speaking with the same kind of immense public platform as Seamus Heaney. But there is I think that dimension of being conscious of speaking in public, as well as also trying to speak in a one-to-one way, is something that has been very, very much sharpened by learning my craft over the last 2 to 3 years in spoken word poetry, where previously it would have been very, very page bound. That is an interesting environment in which to learn to try and balance those two qualities. It's good to know that it's, you know, an experiment that seems to be going in the right direction.
It is coming through, definitely. So kind of backpedaling slightly, we've jumped right in at the deep end, but...
I wouldn't have it any other way.
We are going to kind of, well, start from the beginning, if that makes any sense.
A very good place to start.
Thank you. We'll begin with... I mean, you mentioned 2 or 3 years being on the circuit. Tell me when you started writing, when you started deciding that that was something that you wanted to perform, and how your work has changed as a result.
Okay. Well, I mean, I have been writing in the sense of just jotting things down on paper since I was very, very young. The earliest memory that I have is of, I think, trying to compose something, a very short rhyming verse on the subject of an eagle when I was about, I don't know, I must have been about 6 or 7.
Did you bring it with you today?
No, I did not. It has been lost to the ages, and frankly, I think we are all better off for it, because I have a vivid recollection of trying to rhyme kilo with below at the age of 6, before I knew anything about half rhymes or how that might have been made to work if I'd tied it in a more subtle way. It was just this absolutely clodhopping, attempting to shackle it to a formal verse pattern in a way that I just couldn't, I didn't have the chops to do. What was I thinking? At 7 years old, to be attempting something like that was just outrageous.
I mean, it was streets ahead.
I've been writing and also having a strong desire to perform and do all this kind of stuff in public since I was quite young. Even when I wasn't, you know, doing my own stuff in primary school, I would be at, you know, I was the little kid who would be doing elocution competitions and, you know, school plays and all that kind of thing. So I was quite used to the idea of performing and, you know, reading poetry in public. But it took a long time for me to become more acquainted with the particular demands that can be expected of poetry as a form, and trying to sound out the subtleties of the way in which it can be used. Coming to consciousness through, I've mentioned Heaney, who completely blew me sideways when I was 15 years old, the first time I came across At a Potato Digging, which I've talked about at length to a lot of people before, so I won't dwell on that too much here. But also, you know, as most teenagers do, I kind of started ingesting this fairly steady diet of Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, would move on to modern poets that really excited me, many of which still do. Don Patterson, Alice Oswald, Kim Moore, I've started to get into more recently, I think is absolutely gobsmacking. Helen Dunmore. Got to kind of rein myself in at that point, because you know, if I'm not careful, then potentially the list of poets that have influenced me in some way gets absolutely enormous.
The acknowledgements for this show will be posted on the website afterwards, by the way.
Yeah, but no, I've had an impulse, I suppose, towards writing and performing for a while, but it took a long time for me to, I think, there came a point when I was sort of in my late teens, early 20s, where I suddenly realised how long the ladder was and how much work I had to do in order to be really, you know, be proud of my work and to have, you know, something put out that I would take seriously and that an audience would take seriously as a poet. And I think by the time I had started coming to performance, open mic gigs, when I was studying for my bar finals in London, I came here in October of 2013, when I started going to my first performance nights. By that point, I think I had started to arrive at a place where I felt like I might now have my own work in good enough shape that I could do something like that.
Brilliant. Tell me a bit about your relationship with the London spoken word scene. Obviously, I've seen you a bajillion times at Unplugged, but also at Fine Line, also at Boomerang, and I know that you're kind of broadening out at the moment. So how long have you been going to Unplugged? Was that your first night?
Unplugged was my first night, and I was a pretty dedicated follower of it for certainly the year of my bar course, because I was lucky enough to be living just round the corner in Chancery Lane. So every Tuesday night, without fail, I was down there. Moved away for a bit to start my first job in Birmingham, and then came back, at which point I resumed the dedicated schedule most Tuesday nights. That schedule has fallen off a bit recently because, as you've mentioned, I'm trying to broaden myself out and see what happens at other people's open mic nights. And Boomerang Club and Fine Lines most recently have been the ones that I've been really impressed by and quite anxious to see more of. Been doing quite regular stints, I guess, either helping out or occasionally featuring or performing at Farrago. Luna, whenever they're putting something out, I will try and get my stuff in there if I can. If not, it's still fun to go along to the launches and see what's what. I've attended Poetry on the Picket Line as a spectator. I have never yet been invited to actually do anything from the picket, but a man can dream. We live in hope. And Silence Found a Tongue, beginning and ending. I went to the very first show and the very last show. I'm very, very sad I didn't get more opportunities to do that. So now I've been trying to acclimatise myself to the eclecticism and the variety of voices that we get on different nights. It's been illuminating.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I've been through a similar experience myself. Also probably around, well, not from as early on as you, but kind of starting to branch out a bit more now, and finding similar things with similar results, similar places that I want to go and haunt. Mm-hmm. So,
Get a vibe. You get a vibe after a while and think, yeah, actually, this can work here.
Speaking of vibes.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about National Poetry Writing Month.
Sure.
Because I think that has been a really special thing to be involved in London, and I'm a little bit scared of it finishing, actually. Why does the relentless march of time keep going forward?
Should write a poem about that.
Yeah, well, I will, or probably some kind of like begging rant on the Facebook group saying, guys, let's keep it going, please. But tell me, explain to people a little bit about what it is and what's going on and your involvement in it.
Sure. I got involved by being roped in, basically, at the end of my first Boomerang Club. Maddie Godfrey, absolutely amazing young spoken word artist, mentioned that she was doing it and then basically just sort of roped me into it after the show. She mentioned, yeah, I'm doing this thing, and then immediately had her phone out and was going, I'll tell you what, I'll add you. And, from that point on, I was in and 6 days behind everybody else. I just caught up yesterday.
What are the rules?
But
tell us the rules.
The deal being that you have to write a poem a day, every day, for 30 days. A completely new material every time, even if it's rubbish, you've got to get something out on paper. We're now up to, it'd be day 23 now, because it started on the 1st of April. It's proven to be incredibly fecund. It's a very, very productive, unexpectedly so. I didn't think that I was going to have the energy or the resources to turn out material, not just material, but stuff that I would be happy to read and stuff that I would be proud of. Including some of the stuff, one of the poems that I've read here came out of National Poetry Writing Month, out of the energy of all of those people working together. But it's, like you said, the community that's formed around it of fellow artists and creators is just astonishing. And when I was trying to recover some of the material from it just to kind of get it down on paper before I lost it, I had this intense feeling of kind of running down the post wall and feeling like I was in a bathysphere. I was plumbing the depths. We were going down and down as far as we could go to pull up this absolutely awesome poetry from lower down. It's become a really fantastic resource. I'm very, very glad that Maddie got me into it. Having said which, I will be quite glad when I can return to just writing poetry when I have the resources to write a poem.
You'll miss it.
Rather than having to write one every day.
You'll miss it.
I expect I will, but there's a part of me that thinks, yeah, maybe I can come up with some good stuff in my own time. We'll see.
It's been fab, and just to have the people rallying round and encouraging all the time, it's been amazing. We're now going to take a quick pause to hear a couple more of Tim's pieces.
And I'm going to go for the latest one then, from 30 and 30, inspired by true events. Just get the version.
As they all tend to be, it's really
nice. Yeah, it's becoming more and more common. Okay. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming. Look for a channel. Lean into the long pause and grope. Thread words through. Be of some use, or try to. That's all I can think of at a time like this. Look for a channel. where you can see your friend and not simply her scattergun texts from the obstacle course of a Paris train, where you swear sometimes that you can smell the reek of beer, that you can hear their rambling progress up the aisle, hear padded seats and someone slurring, "Sit here." Look without blinking into the screen for the next second of dancing ellipses and hope that there is a shared future of mutual rage at what happened that night, and you will see the other side of the white, unthinkable space where she is not writing. And if only for now, I will write for the both of us. That's all I can think of at a time like this. Look for a channel. Look. And keep looking. I am trying to make something live. I am trying to make something live past the event, hoping to be faithful. There was a grace in being allowed to have the tiny, local promise of a whole-hearted hug when it could have gone so wrong. Finding the pillow spot against your cheek, a revisiting, a revelation, another promise folded in the ache. Here, then, is my demand for honest speech. Second sealed in our hands, and then, take care, incisions, friendly openings in the air. We both, I hope, were lighting upon what would always still be there and I could reach toward. Be in my life. I would love that.
Let's talk about your work a little bit.
Oh boy.
I know. I'm gonna throw things out there and you're gonna come back at me.
Sure.
So what I have noticed, in my humble opinion. I guess I want to talk to you a little bit about recurring themes of... There's a kind of spiritual level of deep contemplation. You take an idea. It's almost imagist in a way, where you seem to take an idea and then you kind of draw it open slowly, and I feel like you might go somewhere else with the poem, but touch back. There's a kind of reeling things into a certain image or a certain metaphor or a certain theme that's going on throughout your work. And that's quite a vague thing to throw out there, but I'm going to throw that out there. Respond to that, please.
No. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that somebody's noticed it, that, you know, there is a light spiritual element to a lot of what I write, partly because I think it's part of my imaginative colouring. I grew up in a Catholic family. And the imagery and the language of Catholic liturgy and Catholic ceremony and the Mass is still very present, and it's very resonant as a language to use. And also just because of some, if and when I do get onto, you know, social or political themes, biblical language, like it or not, is still quite resonant. You know, anybody who's involved in social justice work has to hear "I Have a Dream," and then you're going to hear a lot of from Isaiah and Amos. So, you know, it's there. But also the fact that I've taken a more recent spiritual turn towards Buddhism, and with it the practice of seated meditation, has affected my poetic method as well as my subject matter. Because as you've noticed, that tendency to keep bringing one's attention back, touching back on the image or the line on which you want to hang the poem and keep your attention there, is something that... I try to keep myself to as a poetic method. I place quite a high premium on the quality of attentiveness, yeah, and a disciplined manner of seeing. This is one of the jobs that I think good poetry has to do for a person who's reading it. It's introducing you to a way of responding to the world and a way of attending to the world that might not have occurred to you before, and that means effectively refining and honing and disciplining your attention to the point where you can look at the world and be open to receiving it in a poetic way. Mm. So if I can achieve that through my poetry, then, you know, I'm onto a good thing, I would think. That encourages me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even just listening to your work today has made me want to do more with form. I mean, I've told you this before, but I'm quite interested in the way that you use the medium of being a man at a mic in your performance, as you know, you find the unique elements of that and you use them to your advantage. For example, the with your chanting, with the tapping of the mic. It's very, that's something that I take from your work more than a lot of people that are out there at the moment performing, I think.
Right.
Yeah, tell us.
That. Well, I mean, yeah, that surprises me. I think it's being around a lot of spoken word artists that I think has made me more conscious of how you use the space in a way that takes advantage of that unique relationship that you have behind the mic, where you're having to engage with and respond to the demands of your audience. But also it invests you with a certain kind of responsibility, I think, as a poet, for taking the time to establish mood, to kind of establish an atmosphere and let people know that here is a place in which they will be receiving language and responding to language in a certain way. It almost, now I say it out loud, it almost sounds kind of priestly. I think there's a bit of the Catholic imagination coming through again. But it is almost like a priest conducting a mass, which has a kind of light dramatic element to it as well, whereby there is a way of responding. The priest will get up in front of the congregation and, you know, it's still kind of a reflex for me to respond to something like, you know, the Lord be with you and also with you. You're doing something similar, I think, in a poetic context. Theatre is one of the other places from where I think I've drawn that kind of influence. I used to do a lot of it. I still hang out with a lot of actors. And taking advantage of letting the audience know that you are now in a space where you're looking at the words in a certain way, I've tried to incorporate that as effectively as I can into the poem. And if I can, use the form, as you've said, to bake it into the words themselves and give you cues as you're reading and as you're listening.
I think it just comes through so effectively.
It's good to know. Thank you very much.
Yeah, very much your style brings it across so much. So, I think we're going to have to wrap up there. I know, it's been great fun. Can you give us a very, very brief little ad or a little discussion of your forthcoming collection, which is in air quotes.
I've got ambitions at the moment to try and write a proper collection, and at the moment it looks as if all of the material I'm getting is going to be geared towards the city experiences of two places that I've spent a while in and put down roots in London and New Orleans, where I interned last year. I am trying now to assemble those poems into something that will sum up how I feel about those places and what they've done to me, both good and bad. Here's hoping I can bring that to fruition at some point in the future. And you know, then it can join the rest of the pamphlets.
Inevitable. Good. Thank you so much for having a chat with us, Tim. And this has been Tim Kiley. I've been Zoe Stegosaurus. I still am. Thank you very, very much for listening, guys. We'll be back with another one of these in a bit.
When you have made division of yourself, you roll apart like waves, and lapped at in the little cove of now, two temporary halves, what until then was a remote subvocal throb that you had missed the first time round, beats in your throat, inarticulate as a fist, making demands. The dim knowledge you had before surges and swells. Now this chest-shaking anchorage resounds, ribs tremble, something pulls on you like a snapping mainsail. Remembering when you straddled the breaker's plummet, would you fail to make return if you were called? Meanwhile, among the rippled sheets, another current undulates, quickens like blood, glimmers and greets your hand with theirs, taking your weight, like the sea's weight, into a whole deep heaviness, shot through with flecks of recognition, with you both wondering what you will say next.